Our next case is State versus Barber. State versus Barber.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Mark Raffel. I represent the appellant in this matter, Jesse Barber. And this is an appeal from the District Court of Dawes County, Nebraska, following the conviction of Mr. Barber for the offense of first-degree sexual assault. The allegations in this case stem from an allegation alleged to have occurred on June 28, 2013. This allegation was not reported to law enforcement for approximately 4 years after that. At trial, the state presented evidence from the alleged victim and a couple other witnesses. After the state rested, the defense did move for a directed verdict at the end of that. And on the motion for directed verdict, the defense did argue at that time that the state failed to establish that the alleged victim, in this case, A.N., did not have the ability to consent and that she actually, that actual sexual intercourse had occurred. The only evidence presented during the state's case in chief about the material element of penetration was the defendant's admission to engaging in that conduct with the victim. It's our allegation, our contention on appeal, that the lower court erred, and after trial, the defense did file a motion for new trial, alleging that the state failed to establish the corpus delicti of the crime of first-degree sexual assault in this case. It's our contention on appeal that the lower court did err in not granting the motion for new trial because that was an error. To sustain a conviction, the state must prove the corpus delicti of a crime beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's essentially the substance of a crime, the fact that a crime occurred without establishing the identity of the person who actually committed it. Extrajudicial admissions or voluntary confessions are insufficient to prove that a crime did in fact occur.
But if they are accompanied by circumstantial evidence, is that enough then?
It is, Your Honor, yes. And my next point was going to be yes. Extrajudicial admissions or confessions are enough to corroborate and satisfy the corpus delicti, but there must be sufficient corroboration in order. First, the state must first establish that sufficient corroboration before the defendant's admission can be used to fill in the gaps and establish those material elements. And it's our contention on appeal that this case lacked any corroboration that an act of penetration had occurred in the state's case in chief. The accuser in this case, A.N., had no memory of any sexual encounter occurring. In fact, when the next morning when the defendant in this case advised her of that fact, she did not believe him. She said the next morning she didn't believe him. And there's no testimony that she had any felt like she'd been involved in a sexual encounter, that she had any pain or discomfort from it. There's no forensic evidence to corroborate a act of sexual penetration occurred. Again, this allegation was made 4 years later.
Are the pictures on the cell phone sufficient?
No, Your Honor, they're not sufficient. The pictures on the cell phone, the record establishes the pictures on the cell phone merely show her in a state of undress. The pictures do not establish any act of penetration. This is not a situation where it's a picture of an act of penetration. It was just pictures of her in a state of undress. And again, the state has the initial burden of satisfying each material element, and the element of penetration would not be satisfied by the photos that were allegedly on the phone in this particular case.
Blood on the bed? Wasn't there evidence of that as well?
There was evidence of blood on the bed, but, Your Honor, that isn't also sufficient corroboration for a couple of reasons. First off, the victim was not even sure that was her blood. In fact, her testimony was that she assumed it was her blood. She never testified that she was bleeding or that she recalled possibly losing any blood. Secondly, just because there was blood on the bed, in other words, we don't know the source of that blood, just because there was blood on the bed doesn't mean that blood came there through a lack of consent or through the act of somebody who is mentally or physically incapable of apprising their conduct. The blood doesn't, just like the pictures, the blood doesn't establish penetration. It just establishes there's blood on the bed.
Well, we have his admission, and then we're starting to piece the rest together, right?
Right.
When you start to put these together, the pictures and the blood, don't we have circumstantial evidence here?
The blood doesn't establish penetration, and so the corroboration needs to be corroborating the act of penetration. Just because there's blood doesn't mean it was the cause of penetration. We don't know if it was from menstruation. We don't know if that blood was prior there at a prior occasion. And I think what's important in this particular case, and I cite to the Wharton treatise, is that the state needs to first present the evidence of the material illness of some in their case in chief, and they didn't do that in this particular case. It only happened after the defendant testified that that evidence came in this particular case. So it's our position that the state did not meet its initial burden, that there lacked sufficient slight corroboration to establish that an act of penetration did in fact occur. And the only way to fill in that gap is through the extrajudicial admissions or confessions of the defendant in this particular case. Our second alternative argument is that the lower court erred in instructing the jury as to without consent. There were no facts to support the giving of that particular instruction. The state presented absolutely no evidence that any facts in this case supported the without consent instruction. As Section 28.318 subsection 8 lists, it lists only four circumstances in which without consent becomes an issue. And that is circumstances in which a victim is compelled to submit due to the use or threat of force or coercion, the victim expressed lack of consent through words, the victim expressed lack of consent through conduct, or the victim expressed consent through, or consent was given through deception. And in this case, there was none of those factors existed, none of them.
What evidence do we have that there was no consent?
I'm sorry?
What evidence do we have that there was no consent by the victim?
Well, we do have, well, the victim's testimony that she doesn't remember the activity would be...
She doesn't remember. Doesn't necessarily mean she didn't consent.
Correct. And, of course, we have at the defendant's testimony to the opposite, that she did, in fact, consent.
Right.
So, again, I don't think there's any evidence. Again, this is a he said, she said case. And
but if we don't have any evidence that she didn't consent, why is the jury instructed on consent or lack of consent?
I don't think they should have been instructed on lack of consent. That's my position. I think this case should have only been instructed on the physically or mentally incapable of apprising the nature of her conduct. It's our contention that unnecessarily injected confusion into this particular case, and I think that's compounded by the fact, I anticipate that state's going to argue that Mr. Barber wasn't prejudiced by that fact, and the defense has the burden of proving that he was in fact prejudiced. I believe that the record does establish that he was prejudiced by that fact, because again, not only did it unnecessarily inject confusion into this case, it shouldn't have been injected because consent was never ever an issue in this particular case, but it's compounded by the fact that the court never instructed the jury that the burden of proof never shifts to the defendant in a criminal case. And that's a bedrock fundamental principle of our system of justice. And when the defendant gets, or when an alleged victim gets up there and testifies that something happened and doesn't recall consenting, and without telling the jury that that burden doesn't shift now to the defense to prove that she did in fact consent.
Didn't the jury instructions toward the end have the standard statements about that the state has the burden to show each element beyond reasonable doubt? That was consistent throughout the... Right.
Yes, Your Honor.
So you read the instructions as a whole.
Correct. The general elements instruction did indicate that the state does have the burden of proving each element beyond a reasonable doubt. But from the perspective of the jury, it was never clear if that was an initial burden or whether or not that burden shifted at some point to the defense, because they were never advised that that burden always stays with the state and never shifts to the defense. And I've never seen in a criminal case a jury not instructed that about the burden of proof not shifting. And in this case, I think that, yes, they did instruct about the elements, but they didn't ever instruct the jury about the burden not shifting. And I think he was prejudiced by that fact. And I would reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honor.
Good afternoon.
May it please the Court, Nathan Liss, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the appellee of the state of Nebraska. I'll take the claims in the same order that Mr. Rappel has argued them. As far as the first issue regarding the denial of the motion for new trial, we maintain that it was properly denied. As set forth in our brief, we submit that the evidence at trial satisfied all the material elements of the offense, including the corpus delicti, so the evidence was sufficient. There was no basis to grant a motion for new trial.
What about the motion for directed verdict at the end of the state's case?
We disagree with the appellant's assertion that a directed verdict should have been granted, and we submit that this argument fails for two reasons. Number one, he's waived his right to appeal from the directed verdict ruling. Our case law is clear that once you present evidence on your own behalf in a criminal case, you've waived your right to appeal from the directed verdict ruling that occurred here, so that claim's not properly before this court. And number two, even if that directed verdict ruling was properly before this court, that's not the assigned error here. The assigned error pertains to the denial of the motion for new trial. That motion was filed after trial, and in ruling on that motion, the district court was obviously permitted to consider all the evidence adduced at trial, including Barber's testimony. So for either or both of those reasons, this court's review is not limited to, and really not even focused on, the directed verdict ruling. The issue before this court is the district court's ruling on the motion for new trial. We consider all the evidence adduced at trial in reviewing that, and upon doing so, we submit that the motion was properly denied.
Can we talk about the trial itself? What evidence was there that the victim did not consent?
Well, there was no evidence, in at least sort of the, when you think of lack of consent, sort of the classic evidence of somebody being approached and saying no, there was no evidence to that effect. If evidence existed here of lack of consent to satisfy the statutory definition, I think it comes down to the provision that says consent or lack of consent includes, among other things, or can include what the victim has expressed through conduct. And when I look at all of the evidence in this case, I mean, she's highly intoxicated. She's looking for a place to stay, to sleep. She comes over here. She goes in his room alone to go to sleep. I don't see anything about that conduct at all that suggests any type of consent or even contemplating sexual activity, in which case, wouldn't the average person assess that scenario to assume that that conduct is a lack of consent to sexual activity upon going to sleep? I mean, I just don't see any way to construe that otherwise. But to answer your question, this is not a clear-cut case of her being conscious and physically resisting, as we often see in sexual assault cases. So it's not, you know, as clean as many cases in that regard, which is why we've, especially in brief, we've just kind of focused on the lack of prejudice from the giving of that instruction, because for the sake of argument, if there was no evidence to support a lack of consent, as Barber argues, well, then there was no basis for the jury to have found him guilty on that theory, which only leaves us with the lack of capacity theory, and the jury either believed that the victim lacked the capacity to resist or appraise the nature of her conduct, as the state alleged, or they believed that she initiated and consented to this entire encounter, as Barber alleged. They obviously rejected his story and agreed with the state's theory of the case, which was supported by the evidence, so we would submit that for the sake of argument, even if that instruction should not have been given, that he can't show prejudice from the giving of that instruction in this case.
So what evidence was there for lack of capacity?
Lack of capacity, well, she's, I think it's undisputed, she's highly intoxicated. I mean, she's thrown up, she's been drinking liquor all night at a party with her friends. We have the guy following her home who says she can barely walk. He was concerned enough that he calls the police just upon seeing her go into the house because he was concerned that something was awry.
And the police have a conversation with her, she's able to communicate with them. My concern is not so much with her inability to consent, but does he not also have to know that she's lacking the capacity to consent?
Well, there is some case law that deals with that, but that's going to just be sort of a general intent consideration. I mean, if the evidence would put a reasonable person on notice that this person in their circumstances is not able to appraise the nature of their conduct, then you're on notice, and you do know at that point. And I think that the evidence in this case would establish a finding that she lacked the ability, in her intoxicated state, she lacked the ability to appraise the nature of her conduct. I mean, we don't know exactly what happened since she doesn't recall, but I think the reasonable inference here could be that she was simply unconscious when this happened, in which case he would clearly be on notice and be aware of her lack of ability to appraise the nature of a conduct, but she's not even conscious. Now, we don't have the exact, direct evidence on that since she doesn't recall, but that's certainly a permissible inference that the jury could have drawn from the evidence, and we would submit that it satisfies the standard here and supports the jury's verdict.
In the Sanders case, which is somewhat factually similar to this, at least in that case, although there was a question of whether she had changed her testimony from the deposition to trial, at least at trial she had testified that she did not give her consent. But here we don't have that. We don't have anything from the victim that said she did not consent. She just said she didn't have any recollection of what happened at all. Is that correct?
I don't recall, Your Honor. I can't recall if the prosecutor did ask just sort of a general question of, I mean, I, given that she didn't recall, I'm not quite sure if they could have asked that, but I don't know if they did. That is my recollection, just that she just has no memory of what happened. So, yeah, I mean, but that doesn't mean that you couldn't, without that question, that you couldn't have evidence establish a lack of consent. I mean, you have, when you look at, like, the Alvarado case, I mean, that victim wasn't, as I recall that case, if I'm recalling it correctly, that victim didn't exactly remember everything either, but you had, you know, some physical signs, some injuries to the defendant, and some testimony that they appeared to be, you know, defensive wounds or, you know, signs of resistance from a victim.
We don't have that here.
No, we don't. I'm not suggesting that we do. I'm just simply indicating that you don't necessarily have to have that question and answer to establish a lack of consent.
Was it erroneous then to include the without consent portion of this instruction? Are you just relying on prejudice? Or would you concede that with this record?
I acknowledge that the evidence here isn't exactly clear, nor is the definition. So I'm going to stop short of conceding it, because I think it comes down to an interpretation of that definition of how do you construe somebody exhibiting a lack of consent through their conduct, as I was arguing earlier to Judge Reben. There's no cases I'm aware of that interpret that, and I think, I mean, you arguably could get there. I mean, this is not a clear case by any means. I don't want to suggest that it is, but to answer your question, I'm going to stop short of conceding that. I acknowledge that the evidence here is not as clear as it could be, nor is the statutory definition, which is why I'm leaning toward the lack of prejudice argument. Really not much else to add. Just briefly, as far as the lack of instruction on the fact that the burden never shifts, as noted in our brief, we'd submit that he can't show prejudice due to a lack of instruction there, given that the district court did specifically instruct the jury both orally and in its written instructions that Barber was presumed innocent, and the state had to prove all elements beyond reasonable doubt. We'd submit there's no basis to assume the jury disregarded that instruction, so we don't see any prejudice from lack of instruction in that regard. As far as the ineffective assistance of counsel claims, I'll submit that on brief. Unless the court has questions, we submit that the record is insufficient to address the bulk of them.
Okay, thank you.
If there are no further questions, we'd ask you to affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
How much time is left for the appellant?
1 minute and 52 seconds, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor. In order to satisfy the consent element in this particular case, I direct the court's attention to Section 28-319, Subsection 1B, Nebraska Revised Statutes. There's a two-part analysis requires, when you look at somebody, whether or not they can, I'm sorry, apprise the nature of their conduct, it indicates that there must be a significant abnormality, such as severe intoxication, not just intoxication, but severe intoxication. And it further goes on to say, on the part of the alleged victim and knowledge of the abnormality on part of the alleged attacker or alleged person. And they cite State versus Collins for that proposition, 7 Nebraska Appellate 187. So again, it does require both severe intoxication and knowledge of the defendant that that's the case.
Do we get to that, or could we find that a reasonable juror could arrive at that conclusion given the testimony of the gentleman who followed her home, went back, called the police, he was so concerned about her, and coupled with her lack of memory?
I don't believe you can get there, Your Honor, for several reasons. First off, her testimony, she testified that she remembered Mr. Barber offering her a glass of water when she got there. She remembered getting directions from her mother to the house. She remembered law enforcement arriving. She remembered recognizing the officer as a resource officer from her school. She remembered conversing with this officer. Mr. Osborne, the witness who called in, testified that she was unsteady on her feet, quote, a little bit, and that he saw her make 4 phone calls on her phone. And then, of course, what perhaps most importantly is we have, this makes this case so unique, we have actually a law enforcement officer arrive at the scene, to inspector in the context of a call concerned about her impairment level, this officer says, and I quote, quote, "she appears okay to me," end quote. And then law enforcement leaves her in the presence of the defendant after making that observation in the context of a concerned call about her intoxication. So I don't believe we get there. And for those reasons and others, we'd ask you to reverse this conviction. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Case is submitted. Counsel is excused.